Now, you remember that last year in our notes from pre-Reformation church history, I had mostly Roman numerals dealing with a different century. And on practically every century, the last main subhead under the Roman numeral was the church at Rome in the first century, or the second century, or the third, or the fourth. And those heads, if you took everything that was in them together, it would give the general outline of what I meant by this question. But of course, sometimes the events that are mentioned were of sufficient importance that they had been discussed under previous heads and were only referred to under that head. As I mentioned last year, we would not pay so much attention to the church at Rome rather than to the church at Alexandria, the church at Antioch, the church at Jerusalem, the church at Lyon, the church at any one of many other great Christian centers, if it were not for the fact that in modern times, the claim is very widely made that the bishop of the Church of Rome is the divinely appointed head of the whole Church of Christ. And since that claim is made today, and the only proper way to answer it is to ask, is there biblical evidence in favor of it? That is what settles it. Church history does not settle it for any other question in theology. It is biblical investigation that answers any question. Nevertheless, it seems only reasonable that if God appointed that the church at Rome, the bishop of Rome, the head of the church of Rome, received from Peter a position as head of the church, and therefore was the supreme head of the church in all ages, it would seem only reasonable then to expect that in the ancient period, the heads of the church at Rome would have been outstanding leaders in the entire church. And it's for this reason that in our course in pre-Reformation church history, we take a bit more time on the church at Rome than we do on the church at many other very important Christian centers. Of course, in one way, Rome is more important than any of the others because it was the capital of the empire. It was the place from which law radiated all through the empire. And therefore, whatever happened there would inevitably have a very considerable influence in the rest of the empire. Nevertheless, in another way, it is less important because the church at Rome was slower in making roots in Rome than in any other, in most other sectors. For the first 200 years or more of the history of the Church of Rome, it was a Greek-speaking church, so Rome was a Latin-speaking town. In other words, it was a church of people who had come to Rome fairly recently, a church not of ancient Romans, but of people who had migrated there. It was a foreign church in Rome for at least 200 years, perhaps for 300. And so, for that reason, it might be less important in a way than in other places. But the one thing that is most important in this consideration is to note the very strange fact that if you take ancient church history, which I would say, well, if you take the history of the church up until 400 AD, in that period, if you name the 30 men who are most important in our ancient records as for the influence they had in the Christian church, that is, after the apostles, of course. The 30 men who, would, if you were to name, who were most important in their activities and their leadership and their insight and their general recognition throughout the Christian world, not one of them would have been a bishop of Rome. And that's a very strange thing. When you have anywhere from 6 to 15 bishops of Rome each century, that there was not a single bishop of Rome up until 450 A.D. who ranked among the outstanding 30 leaders of the first 400 years of church history. Now that, of course, is, I might say, more important than anything else in connection with this book. But then, as you went through, you remembered what we discussed of that period. You remember that after 200, we had Hippolytus, who was recognized as a great saint through the Middle Ages and highly revered by the Roman Church. And that in the 19th century, a lost writing of Hippolytus was rediscovered. There's no question of its authenticity. And in it, he describes two of the popes two of the bishops of Rome early in the 3rd century as being crooks and scoundrels and men who were doctrinally unsound. And of course, all sorts of excuses are made to try to get around that today, but nobody denies that Hippolytus actually wrote those things about Bishop Zosimus and Bishop Callistus. And then in the middle of the 3rd century, we have the great persecution of Decius, and at that time, we have a bishop of Rome who was elected, and another one had a minority, but yet a very large minority of votes, and the church split. And so many people thought the second man was so much better fitted to be Church of Rome that their followers constituted a large sect throughout the empire for several centuries after that. And these novations were highly regarded for their great orthodoxy. Nobody has ever called them heretics. So they denied that the Bishop of Rome was the one who should be from then on. And then you remember that at the end of the 3rd century, when we had the great persecution of Diocletian, that a century later the claim was made that the Bishop of Rome at that time apostatized and denied the faith. Though the Romanists today assert there's no proof that is true, but they say most likely he did prove lacking in courage or something to give rise to that story. Of course, it's pretty hard to prove absolutely in a time of great persecution like that. And then we have the 4th century when Christianity became the religion of the empire, and we have a few things about bishops of Rome then, but not mostly extremely creditable things, which we mentioned in our discussion. As I say, I would much rather take time on some of the great leaders in other places. But in view of the claim made today, it is necessary that we know what the actual situation was. And therefore, I ask that question. And it's so important, I might even ask it again in the final examination. Incidentally, the final examination will review everything up to 500. It will review everything in the ancient church up to 500 for those who had pre-Reformation church history last year. Now, if those of you who are taking church history for the first time this semester will excuse this time we've spent on this review of last year's work, you may find it a good preparation, however, for what you will get when you have pre-Reformation church history. We will now return to our history of the 16th century. And in that, we were looking last time at the heading G under 5. 5 was the victory of Protestantism in Great Britain in the 16th century. And under that, G was the Reformation in Scotland. And we had noticed something of the political situation in Scotland, and we had noticed the great activity of John Knox, and how in 1560, John, under the leadership of John Knox, the Parliament of Scotland, including the leading nobility and the middle nobility of Scotland, and also representatives of all of the sizable towns of Scotland, voted by an overwhelming majority, about 90%. They voted to do away with Roman Catholicism as the religion of Scotland and to break all ties to the Bishop of Rome. And this seems very strange to us today, that a nation would so overwhelmingly change so rapidly. But as we have noticed, it's easily understood when we recognize the corruption which was so characteristic of the Roman Church at that time. Until the Reformation got well underway, they did not set to work to make up good arguments for their position and to train men to debate for it and arouse people in their outlying districts strongly in its favor. It was the Jesuit order which took up that task with a strong will. And once they took it up, it was very difficult to win any nation away from Romanism to Protestantism again. Macaulay has spoken in his history of the fact that in southern France you will find towns which, in the years since the 17th century, have completely abandoned Christianity and become utterly atheistic. and then which completely turned away from atheism and became strongly Romanist. And this process has gone back and forth two or three times, but with never any introduction of Protestantism in the course of that period. And this was due to the work of the Jesuits and others stimulated by them, which so conditioned people against Protestantism and against biblical study in those Romanist areas during that period. But this had not yet occurred in the 16th century. And so the great bulk of the educated people and of the people of leadership in Scotland recognized the great corruption and laziness and general selfishness of the leaders of the Romanist Church at this time and their failure to give any real instruction to the people, and they gladly followed the influence of that very able and extremely active man, John Knox, in his urging that they make a complete break with Rome. And so in 1560, the Parliament took that decisive action. We noticed last time that they were able to do this partly because, at John Knox's invitation, the English government had sent a fleet and an army, not to interfere in Scotch affairs, but to prevent the French from interfering. But were not for this, the French would have interfered and forced them to continue Roman. But the French did not want a war with England over this issue at that time, and seeing that that's what it would mean, the coming of the English army and the English fleet led them to make a treaty in which they both agreed to keep hands off the situation. However, as we have noticed, the government, the rule of Scotland at this time, had been in the hands of Mary of Guise, this French woman, who was the widow of King James V of Scotland. And Mary died just shortly before this parliament was held. Now, Mary had been ruling for 15 years in the name of her young daughter, Mary, also called Mary. And her daughter, while still a young girl, had gone to France because she was betrothed to the King of France. Or that is the son of the King of France. And you remember that when Francis II became King of France at the age of 16 in 1558, that his bride, who was 15, was this Mary from Scotland. And the young boy and his young wife were taken by their uncle to see the Protestants whom they had massacred and were treated to displays of this sort of cruelty against them. Young Francis II, of course, was too young to have any voice in the government, and after a year and a half of sin, he died. And so the young girl, still in her teens, was now a widow of a king in France, but she was nominally the Queen of Scotland. And when her mother died in Scotland, it seemed there were those who said she should go to Scotland and reign there. When she was Queen of France, she and her husband had a dishes made on which they put the arms of France, of Scotland, and of England, claiming to be rulers of England. Because, they said, Elizabeth of England is a usurper. Her mother, they said, was not properly married to her father under the circumstances, you remember, of the break with Rome. And consequently, they said, she is illegitimate, has no right to be queen, and Mary is next in line. And the English had objected to that, and part of their treaty with France was that they should discontinue this practice. Now in 1561, Mary sent word she was coming to Scotland to reign. She was 19 years old, trained in France, trained in all the arts of femininity for which the French have always been famous. She was half French herself, a very attractive woman, very able in many ways. And she was devoted to the Roman Church. Now in 1560, the year before, the Parliament had ruled that Romanism was given up in Scotland, and John Knox always insisted that the mass in which the priest claims to be able to take the bread and wine and actually change it into the body and blood of Christ, and in which they hold it up before the people and the people bow before it, Knox said, that is idolatry. He said, I fear one mass more than a whole French army. And the Parliament had enacted that it was forbidden to perform the mass anywhere in Scotland. Well, now Mary was coming back to reign, and she was an ardent Romanist. And before she came, arrangements were made, and she said, of course, I must have the right to carry on my religion as I believe it. And so they agreed she could carry on her services in her own castle, private. But there was to be no public mass. There were to be no public Romanist services in Scotland. Well, this was the situation. The young woman, a little experience in statecraft, a great deal of experience in dealing with people, some of whom were very friendly and some of whom were antagonistic to her, a tremendous lot of charm, a very considerable amount of intelligence. She came over, advised to move rather slowly and to win people to herself and to win the nation completely back to its loyalty to the Pope. Now, during this year, Knox had been training people to give good biblical instruction. They had been distributing copies of the Bible in different parts of Scotland. They had been sending preachers out to various areas. They had been having the churches from which the mass and the ceremonies, the old ceremonies, had been done away. They had been having the men preach in them as often as they could get around to them and sending things for it to be read by local people when there was nobody to preach. They had been trying to spread the knowledge of the Bible, but they'd only had about a year to do it. Knox preached in the big church in Edinburgh, and his attendances were his services were very largely attended. He was a very fervent preacher and had a tremendous interest. Yes? He had no claim to the throne of France except that he had married the king, and of course he had died. So that claim ended completely with his death. And Mary, as Queen of France, had had a mother-in-law, the widow of the last king, who, when her husband was living, had absolutely no power in France. He had no use for her at all, this Italian woman who was his wife. And when Mary was queen, her uncles reigned this. But now her mother-in-law took over, and he was the real ruler for the next 40 years. And she and Mary never had gotten together in France. So he had absolutely no claim to France. And in fact, now that Mary was in Scotland, she felt that the best way to strengthen herself would be to make alliance with France's great enemy, Spain, which was equally or more devoted to Romans. And so she immediately entered into negotiations with Philip II of Spain, perhaps the most fanatical ruler in all history. He had been married to Mary, Queen of England, you remember, during the 5 years that this Mary had reigned. She was trying to make an arrangement to marry his son, Don Carlos. And so they thought this arrangement would unite Spain with Scotland, and then with the power of the two of them together, they surely could take over England and establish her in what they claimed was her rightful position as Queen of England. Well, Mary set to work in Scotland to she had her private service, but she invited the leading nobles to come to her service. And it was a great honor to be invited by the Queen to come to one of the services in the palace. And consequently, she watched out for those whom she would bring in, whom she thought she could win over to her viewpoint. And she heard about Knox's great influence, and so she invited Knox to the palace and tried to win him. And Knox had written her before she came And he had told her that he did not personally think she should be queen of Scotland. He thought there should be a king, not a queen anyway. And he did not think they should have a queen who was a Roman from viewpoint. But he said, the people of Scotland wish to have you. And I am willing to personally to agree to what the people desire. He said, Paul submitted to Nero as ruler and was loyal to him, and I am ready to submit to you. And so he wrote her this letter before she came. Well, now she thought she would like to win him, and so she invited him to the palace, and there in the presence of her nobles, as she talked to him and did her best to win him, even on one occasion, when Knox was about to install a man in a superintendency in a large section of northern Scotland and over the church there, and Mary, with her feminine intuition, had been able to recognize that this man was just a time servant who was looking out for his own advantage and not truly interested in Knox's religion, she gave Knox the tip about the man's character. And although Knox had been welcomed into the contrary, he found she had been right in that. This is what you call taking a step backwards in order to take two steps forward. She gave him good advice, in this case, to advance what he believed in order to win him to herself. However, this was only one of the various things she was trying to do, and her effort, while she did win more and more acceptation among the people with her great charm and with her plans on how to attract them and how to give honors to those who would be pleased with particular honors and won to herself, and gradually got some of the nobles to have mass privately in their own places to invite their friends, and she was making progress in these regards. Yet it was greatly hampered by the fact that the Scotch leaders as a whole were extremely questioning about her plan for a marriage with the son of the King of Spain. And Knox even preached against this very strongly. And when he did so, she summoned him to the palace. And there, in the presence of the nobles, she accused him of treason for publicly criticizing her plans to marry. He said, what right do you have to discuss my marriage? And he told her that as a presenter of the word of God to the people, that which affected the people of the land, it was his right and his duty to deal with if it was something that presented grave dangers to the nation. And she had been so angry with him on this occasion, she expected the nobility there to vote unanimously to condemn him for treason. But after his defense before her, they even voted to unanimously to sustain him, that he had done nothing deserving of prison. One time when she heard of a sermon she had preached in which there were statements made that had been quoted to her as being critical of her in a way that was wrong and that no subject should use about the ruler, she summoned him to the palace and she loudly denounced him for having said these things, and he said, but ladies, what you've heard is a little bit twisted. It's somewhat like I said, but not exactly, and also, if you heard it in context, it's very different from the impression you have. He said, is that so? She said, this is what I was told. He said, well, he said, let me tell you what I really said. So then he proceeded to give her the whole sermon. And so he preached the whole sermon before her. But Knox had friends all over Europe, and Knox knew better what was happening in Europe than she did. He was constantly interviewing, getting letters from his friends there, and knowing the situations in Europe, and the Dutch people, many of them even who were personally favorable to her, could not favor this marriage with this young son of the King of Spain. And she'd never seen him, by the way. It was purely a political arrangement. And when she was still pushing in that direction, suddenly it was announced that the King of Spain had made an arrangement for his son to marry another woman. And this, of course, ended her plans in that direction, though the King of Spain still wanted to work to make her Queen of England. When Mary heard this, now we find the other side of her character. She was like most people. She was far from being entirely sanctified or entirely devoted, single-minded to any one particular cause. She had her great desire to serve the Roman Church and to advance. She had her great desire to become Queen of England as well as of Scotland. She was far more interested in that than in reigning in Scotland. But along with it, she had her personal feelings, which often seemed to have gotten the best of her by far. And so at this time, she was rather irked at the attitude of the King of Spain, and she found a young Englishman who was a Roman Catholic, very attractive, handsome man, came as in some way representing Queen Elizabeth, came to Scotland. He had relatives in Scotland, and he sued for her hand in marriage, and she accepted him. And the announcement was made that she would marry Lord Darnley. Now, Darnley, D-A-R-N-L-E-Y. Lord Darnley was the great-grandson of King Henry VII of England. You remember Henry VII's daughter, Margaret, his oldest daughter, had married King James IV of Scotland, and she was the grandmother of Mary, Queen of Scots. Well, James IV of Scotland, her husband, had been killed in battle while very few years after she was married, and she had married again. And Darnley was her grandson through her second marriage. So this was a marriage of those who would be, they were not first cousins. They were first cousins as far as the grandmother was concerned, but the grandfathers were different. The Knox felt that it was too close a marriage, that it should not be, there should not be a marriage as close a relation as that. It's not quite like first cousins, though. It's somewhat questionable. He also felt that Darnley was not of a character to be King of Scotland, and he criticized it in his sermon. He criticized making a man King of Scotland who was of the character that Darnley was generally understood to be. Well, she married Darnley, greatly attracted by this very handsome man, but within a few weeks she was utterly disillusioned about it. And so within a few weeks she began to say, he wants to be King of Scotland, he's going to have what to do and nothing more. I'm the Queen of Scotland and he's my husband and that's all he is. And she began began treating him in a way that made him very angry. And she had an Italian secretary named Rizzio, R-I-Z-Z-I-O, who was very active with her in planning the scheming for the progress of Romanism in Scotland. And she spent so much time with Rizzio that Darnley became very jealous. And one day, Darnley and a group of his friends broke into her apartment and attacked Rizzio, and in front of her, stabbed him to death. They killed him there in the apartment. And Darnley and two or three of the friends remained after the rest left in order to explain to Mary how he was entirely justified in having killed Rizzio, and tried to soften her tears and her great upset over what they had done right in front of her. Well, for a little bit, she was quite pleased, Darnley, with great dislike. But then she decided to make Darnley think that she had completely forgiven him for this. Did she do this? Because she was, because she felt it was good policy? Did she do it because she was expecting to have a child, which might be an heir to the throne of Scotland? Or did he do it because she had lost her head sometime before this
And now it was becoming much stronger over a Scottish nobleman named Bothwell, B-O-T-H-W-E-L-L. Bothwell was a strange combination. He was a man who was a very able soldier, extremely able soldier, and for some reason he had a loyalty to Protestantism. He called himself a Protestant. He had a loyalty to Protestantism, but it's hard to reconcile it with his character, which was utterly contemptible in most ways. And Mary became tremendously fascinated by Bothwell. Well, which of these three factors are all together caused what happened is hard to say. But when Lord Darnley was sick, they took him to a cottage called Kirk of Field, which was on the outskirts of Edinburgh, in order that he could recuperate better. And she visited him there every day and was very nice to him there. And one night she said to him, "There is a function in the palace that I have to be present at. I will have to go back to Edinburgh pretty soon." And she left it early in the evening and went back to Edinburgh. And an hour later, the cottage was blown up with gunpowder. Great explosion that they could hear miles away. The cottage was blown up. She and Bothwell rushed out to the scene, and they found his body 100 feet or so away from the cottage, lying dead there. And the whole mystery of just how it happened or what happened has never been explained. But, of course, he professed to be very, very sad about it, and Bothwell joined with her in the great sorrow over the death of Darnley. But the people generally felt that it was Mary and Bothwell who had blown up her husband. And they had pictures showing a little baby. Saying, "Avenge my father." And these pictures were distributed through Edinburgh, posted up different places, and it caused a great change in the attitude of the Scottish people toward her. Shortly after this, Bothwell's wife got a divorce from him. She got the divorce on the ground that he had seduced one of her maids. And this was the ground on which the Protestant court gave the divorce, but in order to satisfy Mary, he also went to the Roman Catholic bishop's court and asked for an annulment. And they gave him an annulment within a few days on the ground that his wife was too closely related to him, being a third cousin of his, and therefore it was wrong for him to have married her in the first place, and therefore the marriage was annulled from the start. When you think of the 10 years nearly that Henry VIII tried to get an annulment on a similar basis, only a much stronger argument from Catherine in England, and the fact that in a few days they gave it to him, it shows the inequity in the arrangements of these Roman courts. One case, they didn't dare displease the emperor. In the other case, it was something that the queen seemed to want. Then Mary asked him to marry her in a Romanist ceremony, and to her great disappointment, he insisted he would only marry her in a Protestant ceremony. So they asked the Protestant leaders of Edinburgh to announce the banns they were to be married, and they utterly refused in view of his character. But they found a less known Protestant minister who performed the ceremony. And so, a comparatively short time after the murder of her husband, she married Bothwell. Well, the result of this was to completely defeat her plan for changing the whole situation in Scotland. He still had many people who were devoted to her. Preserved Smith tells us in his book on the Reformation how a piece of embroidery that Mary had made was kept and treasured almost as the relic of a saint among his ancestors, right down in his family to his time. And she was so attractive in so many ways that she won people to herself, and many have represented her as a martyr, On the other hand, when you see her life and the way that she failed in the great ambition she had because of her inability to control herself, you can't help agreeing with the statement she made once. She said, "There are two people in me." She said, "One is the servant of God, and the other is the tool of Satan." She said, "One is a noble woman, and the other one is a slut." And it would seem to have been the situation with her life. Yes? Yes, by Darnley. She had a son by Darnley who became king of Scotland. That is a very important question, and it affected the history of all of Great Britain for many years in all future times. When the Parliament voted to condemn her for murder of her husband and to force her off the throne, and they took her half-brother and made him the regent, they put her in a castle where she was well taken care of but separated from others, and she managed to escape from the castle and march with an army toward Glasgow to take back the power, but she was met and defeated and left the country, went to England and asked Elizabeth for asylum, and she remained in England the next 19 years. Incidentally, if any of you feel like some light reading that would make this period rather vivid to you sometime, I would like to recommend Sir Walter Scott's novel called The Abbot. If you read the first 3 or 4 chapters of The Abbot, it gives you a good picture of the religious situation in Scotland at this time. Then the next half of the book deals with interesting situations that don't have much to do with the main thing, and you sort of go from one thing to another. And if you feel like skipping the next half, why do it? You might come back and read it later. But then you find this young fellow in the story is sent to the castle where Mary is kept. And there he is put in her service. And the picture it gives of Mary and of the whole situation from that until her going to England is probably very true for history and is extremely interesting. He shows the eldest son in the castle, a man whose family was devoted to Protestantism, and whose older brother was in fact the leader of the Protestants in Edinburgh. He shows him being won to such a great personal fascination for Mary that he just throws everything away in order to help her escape, and eventually he loses his life in the battle. And then it shows her regretting, saying, "Everyone that I had concern with, things go wrong in some way." It's a beautiful picture of the situation at the time. But she went to England then. Her half-brother, Lord James, was made the regent of Scotland. And in England for 19 years, she lived in a castle in northern England under rather carefully watched by Elizabeth's people. When she heard that her half-brother, the strong Protestant leader in Scotland, had been assassinated, she gave a pension to the man who had assassinated her. And she did a number of things like that during those years, but she was constantly involved in plots to assassinate Elizabeth because she was the next heir to the English throne. And eventually, as we noticed when we looked at the history of Elizabeth, eventually the English government decided the only way to protect England from these constant threats, in which Mary was definitely implicated, was that she be executed for complicity in these murder conspiracy. This happened in 1587, 1587, and when that happened, the King of Spain knew that now if Elizabeth died, it would not be a Romanist who would be next in line to succeed, and so he began the great invasion of the Armada, which is so important in English history and also in the history of the Reformation.
But in Scotland, her baby boy, whom they called James, was crowned as King of Scotland. He was not yet a year old. He was raised, his uncle, half-uncle, was regent until he was assassinated. And James was raised by the best way they could find to raise him to be a great Protestant king. But he had the blood of Darnley and of Mary in his veins, and he was a very peculiar combination. When he was old enough to become king, he loved theology, and he could debate any facet of theology he wanted. He was a very strong Calvinist, as all the Scots were at this time. But he also believed very strongly in the divine right of kings. And the system of government that Knox had set up in Scotland was the system of government of the church was one in which each church elected its elders and the church called its ministers. Yes? It's a half-brother. Yes, half-brother. And Mary, the system of government of the church in Scotland, each church elected its elders. Each church called its ministers. The elders and the ministers together ran the church, and their representatives had a surveillance over different sections of Scotland. Well, as James grew up, very anxious to have the divine right of kings established, he got a series of laws passed that they called the Black Laws, because these laws put the church completely under his control and changed the organization to have bishops who would rule in the church. After 10 years, the movement against these laws became so great that these laws were repealed. But James was not at all satisfied with this religious situation in Scotland. He said, "Presbytery and monarchy agree with each other as well as God and devil." He said, "Where there's no bishop, there's apt to be no king." And so in 1504, when Elizabeth died and he became King of England, he went to England with a great desire to prevent any such organization of the church in which the king wouldn't be supreme ever getting introduced into England. And of course we have our King James Bible, which we name after this son of Mary, Queen of Scots. But in Scotland, the result of these situations was that the bringing back of the Roman Catholic Church did not succeed. By this time, the Jesuit order had become strong enough. They had able men prepared who could go into most any country and make very strong arguments and debates and very skillfully carry on plans to win the nation to loyalty to the Pope, but they had no access to Scotland. They were more interested anyway in trying to get control of England. And Scotland, for the next 300 years, was a great center of Christian teaching. The people of Scotland, who before that time had been largely fighting and marauding, and there'd been comparatively little education among them, now began to be trained in order that everyone could read the Bible, and they began to branch out into other fields of knowledge, and many of them became very energetic and able workers in many fields of thought. The Reformation made a tremendous step forward for Scotland. And of course, through James, Scotland became united with England. So instead of being enemies, they became friends. I was with some Australian fellows one time, and they were making Scotch jokes because of my Scotch ancestry. And they were telling about the man who woke up and found his wife had just died and calls down to the maid and says, "Only put on one egg this morning." And they were telling about the man who left England
started for Scotland, and every time the train would stop, he'd get off and run into the station, and then he'd run back again, get on the train, and somebody said, well, what are you doing this at every station for? Well, he said, I've just been examined by a specialist in England, and he says my heart's bad, and I may drop dead any minute, so I'm only buying my ticket for one station at a time. And they were telling all these sorts of Scotch jokes, and I got a little tired of it. And I remember one I had heard, so I said, you know, I said, I've heard a Scotch story too. He said, what's that? Well, I said, I heard of a Scotchman who came up to London and took a position in the government. And somebody saw him, and they said, Doc, how do you like London? Oh, he took a fine place, very fine. Well, he said, how do you like the English? Well, he said, I'm really not in a position to make much of a judgment about the English. You see, my business is mostly with heads of departments. And they had no more Scotch jokes to tell after that one. I had heard that story sometime before, and it just fit in the situation. But there's just enough truth to it to make some English rather irritated to hear it. Because the union of Scotland and England has resulted in the Scotch having a tremendous outreach through England. And we will see some of the elements of that as we go on in the church history. But Scotland had been constantly an enemy of England till the time of James I, and this fact of his becoming king of England united the two nations and made them stand together as a Protestant bulwark for the next 300 years. Of course, during this last century, modernism has infiltrated both nations to such an extent that when we were in Edinburgh a few years ago, it was really shocking to see how, as you visit the great places that were important in Protestant history, where a few years ago they would have shown you with great pride where Knox did this and where that happened and so on, today the guides are running all of that down and criticizing Knox, and the general attitude has been taken over to a very, very great way by the modernist infiltration, which has been so successful in these last few years, both in Scotland and in England. But there were 300 years of great Christian history in both countries. And of course, this history was due to men like Wishart and Knox in Scotland, and the men in England like Tyndale and Cranmer and Ridley and these others who studied the Bible and who gave their lives to make the Bible known and to reach people with the knowledge of the Word of God. But these political situations we've looked at were used in the providence of God in order to make it possible that the people would have a chance to hear the gospel, and that the efforts to stop them from hearing the Bible would not succeed. And so it's good for us to know something of these political developments that God used in his providence to make it possible that Great Britain should become a great center for those 300 years, for the dissemination of the gospel in many different areas. Now, that's as far as we'll speak about G at present. We want to look at H now, and H is the rise of Puritanism in England. The rise of Puritanism in England during the reign of Elizabeth. We have already noted how, in the providence of God, the reign of Elizabeth in England was the means that was used to protect the Protestant movement from destruction. How cleverly Elizabeth handled political affairs and prevented the attack of the Armada for 30 years after she became queen, and how she handled things in such a way that Protestantism would not be immediately attacked and destroyed, but it would have a chance to be spread through the nation. We notice that those who suffered for Romanism in those days did not suffer for religion. No one was persecuted for religion in Elizabeth's reign. That is, for Romanism. Nobody was. But they were those who were Romanists who were put in prison or who were executed. It was because of plots against Elizabeth's life in order to make Mary Queen of Scots as Queen of England. And during this time, the Protestantism spread through the land. So that of the rank and file of English, probably 70 or 80% of them would have been inclined towards Rome at the beginning of Elizabeth's reign. And by the end of her reign, probably not more than 10% of the people would have been. It was a great change in England and a protection of England which was done through Elizabeth. And so it is very easy to think to make Elizabeth a great Protestant heroine and to think of her as think of her many fine qualities and to forget the other side of her character. But I think we make a mistake in doing so. To how great an extent Elizabeth was interested in the Bible. Whether she was actually saved or not, I don't think we are in a position to judge today. She was used of God to protect Protestantism in England and allow it to become dominant there. She was greatly used in this way. But if it were not for England, for Elizabeth, the Protestant Reformation would have been far more thoroughgoing in England than it was. Now that we're speaking now of English Puritanism in Elizabeth's reign, number one, the origin of the name. The name Puritan, in its origin, simply meant that they wanted to purify the church services from forms and ceremonies that they felt looked more like idolatry than like Christian teaching, and to make the study of the Bible the primary thing rather than forms and ceremonies. That's the original meaning of the word Puritan. We look further at it at our tomorrow morning, and we will not meet the service.